Today's episode comes not from Silicon Valley, but from Pakistan. Population? 227 million. It's the world's fifth most populous country. The capital? Islamabad. The GDP per capita? Around $1,200. Top exports? Textiles, cotton, and cereal and grain products. All right, I want to start with some statistics. First, about 22 to 25% of Pakistan's GDP comes from agriculture. That makes it, depending on how you measure it, an industry worth between $60 and $100 billion. Second, 40 to 45% of Pakistan's eligible workforce works in the agriculture industry, from farming to trading to transportation and logistics. That's nearly 30 million people. So with agriculture making up such an important part of Pakistan's economy and even their social fabric, surely you'd think groceries, they'd be accessible and affordable in Pakistan, right? Well, wrong. The farm-to-table supply chain in Pakistan is so inefficient and so inequitable that A, 40% of agricultural products are wasted, expired, perished before they can even get to the grocery store. B, the price has gone up four times. Yep, four times between being picked at a farm and being sold to you at the cash register. And because of that, C, with Pakistan having a GDP per capita of around $1,200 and with the price of groceries so disproportionately high to Pakistanis' earnings, Pakistanis spend, get this, 30% of their disposable income on food items. 30%. And perhaps most shocking, despite how much of Pakistan is built on agriculture, it remains, to this day, a net importer of agricultural products. Imagine. So, with such a massively sized industry bringing about such massive problems, that's where Abrar Bajwa and Taza come in, to make Pakistan's agricultural supply chain more efficient and, more importantly, more equitable. And in just five short months, their numbers are, well, for a lack of better word, unbelievable. Active customers, 1,500. GMV, nearly $1 million. Money raised, the biggest pre-seed in Pakistan's history, $6.5 million. And the impact they've had on farmers, wholesalers, retailers, and consumers? Sorry, MasterCard. Already priceless. I'm David Zabinski.
And I'm Abrar Bajwa.
And this is Not From Silicon Valley. Abrar, welcome to the show. So let's start, as always, with you telling me a little bit about where you grew up.
So I grew up in multiple parts of Punjab, mostly. I grew up in a city called... My first year was spent in Narowal, in my village. Then I spent my early childhood in Faisalabad. That's where I got went to school, primary school, middle school. Then I moved to a cadet college, or an Air Force military cadet college, when I was 12. I spent ages between 12 and 18 in Sagoda. Then I moved back to Faisalabad for a few years. But I've been all over the place.
All right. So you spent the formative years of your youth from 12 to 18 in, what was it, Sargodha?
It's called Sargodha.
Sargodha. All right. So tell me about Sargodha.
So Sargodha is about 2.5 hours northwest of Lahore, which is the central city. It's a city known for being one of the largest air force bases that Pakistan has. It is also known for oranges that they produce.
Sounds like Florida.
Possibly.
But seriously, you know, I don't think many Americans, for example, would think of Pakistan and then think of oranges, which begs my question. Abrar, you grew up all over Pakistan in different places. If there was one thing about your youth and growing up that you'd want people who have never been to Pakistan to know, what would that be?
So Pakistan, like you said, is probably a huge palette of different seasons. It's a palette of landscapes. It's a palette of culture. So every 10, 20 kilometers you move, you're probably speaking a different dialect or a different language altogether. It's a melting pot of multiple landscapes, seasons, and cultures and ethnicities. So, you know, if you go to all the way to the north, you have the second highest mountain in the world, situated in called K2, and it's probably the hardest mountain to climb. If you go all the way down south, about 1,500 kilometers, 2,000 kilometers, what you get is very beautiful sandy beaches in Karachi and all the way on the coastal highway. In terms of culture, you see so many different people. In terms of the food or cuisine that we eat, it's so different. In terms of like the variety of agriculture produced, something close to our heart, it's so many things. So Pakistan is like a very, very diverse place from multiple perspectives. So I think that's a message that I want people to take away.
Yeah, man. As you know, I live in Dubai, right? And there are so many Pakistanis here who have opened my eyes to the beauty that is Pakistan. I've never personally been, but man, if you're listening, you get a chance. Just Google image like Pakistani mountains or Pakistan greenery, Pakistan lakes, Pakistan beaches. You'll be amazed, Abrar, right?
Absolutely. That's right.
All right. So back to you. You mentioned you're 18. You're in Sargodha, not Florida, near this massive Air Force base. Did you enter the Air Force after high school?
So that was the plan. That's how I grew up thinking. That was the dream. But my sort of dream got broken as I went to the Air Force medical. They have a medical board, and what they determined at that point was that I'm almost 1 inch taller than what I was supposed to be if I were to be a fighter pilot, like an Air Force pilot. I ended up being relegated to being an engineer. That was not something very interesting for me, and therefore sort of I completely changed the career path that I grew up thinking about.
Too tall to fly, huh? So when was this?
So this is 2003.
2003, Air Force Base, Pakistan. This is at the height of the war on terror, right? In nearby Afghanistan. Abrar, can you talk about that? What was that like just over the border as this Air Force engineer?
Yeah, so it was basically a very sort of interesting time. Although since we were working in a cadet college, it was almost cut off from the outside world. So all the news that we used to get was mainly from the 9 p.m. news broadcast that used to happen. But I think what we were growing up from is the main focus was we were seeing these movies, these songs, all these motivational speeches all about growing up and getting into Air Force. We wasn't really sure who the enemy or the target was. It was just that, we had to be Top Gun pilots like Tom Cruise and Top Gun, just that was the dream. But, in terms of understanding or being sensitized to the macro picture, we weren't, because we were in a very sort of secluded bubble. We were just sort of being taught how to sort of grow up as gentlemen, as officers and all that, but, never really with the macro picture in view.
So what'd you do after the Air Force?
So yeah, so as soon as I left Air Force, I got into, my father was into textiles. He said that, why don't you be a textile engineer in the same town I grew up in, which is Faisalabad. Faisalabad is the textile hub of Pakistan, right? So he said, why don't you come over and, start textile engineering? And I, not knowing anything better, I said, sure, let's do that.
Ah, you worked at your father's factory?
That was the plan, but I eventually did not end up working in my father's factory, because as soon as I graduated, I found a job and my father said that, why don't you work in my factory? And I just wanted to do something of my own independently. So I said, maybe let me sort of now spread my wings and do something of my own as opposed to working in my father's factory.
Who'd you work for?
So I ended up working in a textile spinning mill. So the spinning mill is basically where, you take in cotton or some other fiber and you end up making yarn or thread, which is used to sort of produce clothes. So I ended up going there. It's in a place called Bhai Peru. It's about 1 hour drive southward from Lahore towards Multan. It's a very small town. I used to live on the plant, so I didn't get to interact with people in the town outside. Very much like my life in Sargodha. But I was on the plant, I was working, I was trying to build a quality assurance process for making sure that the company has processes that can qualify it as an ISO 9000 certified company.
And from there?
And from there, I started realizing that there is no growth in what I'm doing. I'd probably be stuck at the same salary, which was around, at that point in time, $100 a month.
Sorry, I just want to stop you there. You're this engineering graduate working at what appears to be a pretty sophisticated factory. Earning $100 per month? That's, what, $1,200 per year? How do you explain that to an engineering graduate hearing this somewhere in the West or even the East? It's hard to believe, right?
It is. But I think at that point in time, $100 could take you a long way in Pakistan as long as you didn't have it. And of course, my father was supporting me. But in many ways, Pakistan is a cheap country to live in. There's like a lot of basic costs, including transportation, including housing, were also taken care of at that point in time. So I used to live on the plant. Food was covered by them. Transportation was almost once a week. I didn't have any expenses at that point in time. But majority of Pakistan's population, and even today, makes that kind of money, right? So a large part of our population makes that kind of money. So it eventually sort of does translate into some kind of lifestyle. Of course, it's not great, but it's subsistence, if you ask me, in today's world.
All right, so you've got the salary that covers expenses, and with dad's help, you're not too excited about this role. What'd you do?
So I started researching about business schools. I had an interest in finance and economics. So I read up articles on Wikipedia, you know, what's finance, what is economics. I started teaching myself all those subjects. I also started preparing myself for a GMAT exam, which was required for the business school that I was planning to get into. I found a business school which was supposed to be the best in Pakistan. It still is. And I thought that, you know, I have to get into this. So I self-taught, I taught myself a bit of accounting, a bit of economics, a bit of finance, and read about GMAT and scored a pretty high number on that. And eventually got admitted, but just possibly by a stroke of luck, I came across this university. And here we are.
What's the name of the school?
It's called Lahore University of Management Sciences, LUMS. It's the best business school in Pakistan, clear.
Unreal, man. And this was when?
So this is 2009.
All right. So 2009, you're this fresh MBA grad with an engineering undergraduate degree on top of the world, right? What was the first gig? Banking, consulting, startup?
So I mean, that was planned. But as soon as I graduated, there was, at that point in time, you wanted to get into these consumer packaged goods or FMCG companies in the world. You wanted to get into the Unilevers, P&Gs, Nestle's, all that, right?
Yeah, so why is that? Why were these big FMCG companies so attractive for you?
So they have really, these companies have done well to capitalize on the population dividend of Pakistan. They're billion-dollar companies.
Billion-dollar companies within Pakistan.
Within just Pakistan, right? They're also supposed to have great careers. And these are companies in which you could even spend all your life and, you know, be content and happy with. At least at that point in time, that was the perspective. So wanted to get into them, but I applied to most of their programs, got a huge reality check that, you know, I couldn't make it, right? I didn't make it. And I had to sort of settle for a government job.
What kind of government job?
So the government job was there was an investment firm, a provincial investment firm called Punjab Investment Board and Trust. They were trying to bring in foreign investment from other countries to Pakistan. I was building business cases for the different investment cases for different businesses in Pakistan so that businessmen could take it and then sort of we could match them with potential investors across the globe. So that's something I started as an intern over there. Most of my batch was working full time. As an MBA, there was a lot of pressure, but I started as an intern. Then they sort of, after 1 month, they said that, you know, you seem all right. So why don't you come on a full-time basis? I said, sure.
Okay. And I imagine this time with a bit of a higher salary?
So it was like almost two and a half times, three times, but not really as much as my class average used to make. So I was still making half of what my class used to make on average.
So what, like $300 per month?
But yeah, almost that, give or take, yes.
Okay, and you did this role for how long?
No, I do that for a couple of months. And then I get a job in the textile space, which I wanted to avoid because I wanted to get into like more FMCG, more finance, something else. But I still get a textile job, which was decent enough. It sort of brought me at the class average. It used to pay about $607 a month. And I did that for about 7-8 months. But that didn't work out either because, again, I was trying to find my feet and, wasn't really very fulfilling and the company wasn't going anywhere. And that's when I sort of applied to Nestle. And I got in, which was kind of a dream.
All right. A huge FMCG international company. Abrar, finally.
Absolutely. But was complete sort of like when you find something, you're really excited about something, but eventually when you get it, it's not exactly what it seemed. So that was the case with Nestle. That's right. It wasn't exactly, I mean, it seems really shiny from a distance, but eventually it wasn't that much. Also because I wasn't working in a part of that company which was the sort of like the central piece. I was working in a part where there was, I was working in sales and sales for their watches business, which was almost like the periphery of the periphery of that business. I started working there eventually sort of didn't get along too well with my boss. And 6 months down the road, here I am back in the market.
Man, isn't it funny how, no matter where in the world a graduate is, the corporate life, be it at a big bank, a big consulting firm, a big multinational, no matter how, in your words, shiny it seems, it's never really what was expected, right? Anyway, you left Nestle in what, 2011?
So this is 2012, late 2012.
Okay, and did something else work out for you?
Yeah, so what did work out was a company called ICI. It was an old British company, which had like presence in almost all across the world. It was in industrial chemicals and commodities. They had recently been acquired by a company called ExxonMobil, which is a Dutch company. And I went there, and it was like such a great experience. It was very different from where I had worked in the past. It was a company that was built for creating leaders. It was a company which was also was doing quite well from a profitability perspective because they were into capital intensive businesses, commodities and all. But what I really liked was how they sort of made sure that were building leaders as opposed to employees and managers. And I think that's where I had probably, in terms of leadership, that's where I learned so much. I spent about 5 years over there, 2.5 years in one role, and then I got promoted within the organization, then another 2.5 years in a different role.
So Abrar, wasn't your passion for, and sorry if I sound a bit patronizing, industrial chemicals that kept you there? It was for, I guess, the first time in your career seeing growth opportunities and feeling as if you were being invested in that kept you there for half a decade.
Absolutely. The culture was outstanding in that organization.
So 5 years, you left in what, 2017? For what?
Got like another FMCG role. I still had that sort of attractiveness towards FMCGs. And I got a role at L'Oreal. L'Oreal is this French beauty company. I got a role in sourcing and purchasing, and I was asked to move to Karachi for that role.
Ooh, Karachi, the big city.
Now I'm the big city, yeah. So now I'm in Karachi and I joined L'Oreal. I do that for 2.5 years. Great organization, great people again. I enjoyed my time so much. At the same time, what's happening in parallel at a micro level is that these technology companies like Kareem are really coming up. I'm completely oblivious to what's happening. Some of my friends work there, but I'm sort of looking at it from skepticism that, what the hell is going on here? What are these technology companies? They don't make any money. How are they surviving? So all those questions, but that is also happening in parallel while I'm working at L'Oreal.
Hey, Abrar, rewind to 2009, right? You're this MBA grad, not an FMCG, on the outside looking in. And now, fast forward a decade or so, and you're in FMCG, but not in tech on the outside looking in. My, oh my, how the grass is always greener, huh?
Absolutely. And then something strange happens. One of my colleagues from the LAMS MBA program, he becomes the country general manager for Kareem. He was doing a role as the director of operations before this. So that role opens up. He calls me up. He says that, I'm looking for somebody who I can, who I have like deep trust in and somebody who I have deep respect for. And we knew each other for a bit now. And he said, could you come over and be my right-hand person for Kareem to lead Pakistan? Of course, there's the interview process, which is like 8 to 10 people interviewing you. But, if you're able to make it, I'd be grateful if you could come over.
Okay, so I live in Dubai, right? I know all too well about Kareem. It's the UAE-born ride-hailing app that eventually gets acquired by Uber for over $3 billion, right? So I know how big a role this would have been for you, but perhaps for those outside of the Middle East and Asia, Abrar, can you just give a little context to Kareem, specifically in Pakistan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kareem has been a game-changer organization for the region, startup ecosystem, for talent, for so many other things. What Mudassar has been able to build against a very strong competition in the shape of Uber as a ride-hailing company is so huge. The impact of that has been so game-changing that it has created a huge talent pool, which is probably participating in multiple startups in the region now. the exit led to a lot of belief. Exit of Careem, which is acquisition by Uber, led to a lot of belief in the region by global venture capital firms. We think of Careem also as a startup academy where, you know, the concept of scaling so fast was not very sort of common in the region. With Careem coming in and doing that, it has completely sort of changed perspectives for people about how startups should be run. And from a Pakistani standpoint, it also became a very lovable brand. It was almost unheard of or unthinkable that, you know, I would let my, for example, mother or my sister or even myself, I would sit in a stranger's car and go away. Pakistan is a low trust society. But the way it has been able to change that over a period of 4 or 5 years is outstanding.
That's a really good point, man. Pakistan being this nowhere low trust society, now adapting ride sharing into their social fabric, getting into strangers' cars. There's always these interesting cultural differences that play a role in adoption. Can you talk a bit more about that, man? I mean, what made Careem work in Pakistan?
So in the early days, of course, it was a lot of convincing, a lot of brand building, a lot of focus on security, a lot of focus on customer service. And it was also a lot of focus on, you know, bringing the pricing at such an attractive level for travel that, you know, the even if you were traveling almost on a luxury car in Careem, it was significantly cheaper than taking, for example, hailing a cab or a rickshaw or something else from the market. So a combination of, you know, focus on trust, safety, keeping the prices artificially low, making sure that, you know, the customer experience is top notch, and make sure that the cars are available all around the country. And I think a lot of credit to the early team in Careem, especially Junaid, Zishan, some of these other people. When they were able to do all of that, I think there was a slow adoption in the beginning. And then suddenly sort of exploded. And it helped both Uber and Careem because both of them were trying to do the same thing, building that trust at the same time. But as soon as they were able to execute this, the market completely exploded. To this date, it's the market which has the largest number of trips for Careem in the, for example, in the region.
I didn't know that. And I guess it was because of that, having this huge market share in a 230 million person population. Even if it wasn't profitable, that led to Uber acquiring it.
It did. And probably this is probably the one of those markets due to which Uber was eventually had to sort of give up and say that, you know, we can't compete with these people, and, you know, the only way to sort of go into our IPO is to actually acquire them before we go there, because this is a huge lose end. Careem is really sort of giving us a very difficult time in the region, especially in Pakistan, and Uber had to sort of fold.
Yeah, so you saw a lot of this firsthand. Surely you caught a bit of the tech bug, huh?
So I think as soon as I got into Careem, a lot of things changed for me from my perspective point of view. I started realizing the value of technology, how technology sort of can leapfrog so many decades of existing business models, how it could sort of change, solve problems which have been existing for years, decades. For example, in the case of Careem mobility for Pakistan. Pakistan does not have great public transportation. And the way Careem was able to solve it for at least a very small percentage of the population, but it still did, right? So it was amazing. I also started working with some of these very young people who were very smart and excited about what they were doing. And this was not something I'd found in my career in the past. So that was interesting. The pace was very interesting. The amount of data intensivity where, you know, you were making most of your decisions based on, you know, hard data. I think that was interesting. I really found my place in the world when I started working at Careem. I started getting fascinated about what else could technology do for a country like Pakistan. Interestingly, that's where this Careem is also where I met my co-founder, Mohsin, who had been there from a much early stage. He joined Careem in 2017. I joined in 2019. And he was able to build the Careem business ground up. He had launched multiple categories for them. He had launched a few cities for them. He was a master builder. And that's when we started interacting and sort of wondering what else could we do? I mean, well, with all the talent that we had, all the experience that we had, all the learnings that we had, all the privilege that we had.
All right. So, you know, you've got this entirely new arsenal of sorts and this entirely new perspective. To answer the question, as you said, what was it? What else could technology do for a country like Pakistan? Well,
So at one point in time, we came to the conclusion that it could only be the agriculture space in Pakistan. And why is that? Because it's the largest space in Pakistan. 20%, 20 to 25% of our GDP comes from here.
How much? 22 to 25%?
And it's the biggest employer in Pakistan also. 40 to 45% of our workforce is associated with agriculture one way or the other.
40 to 45%? That's what? Tens and tens of millions of people working in farming and transportation and trading and wholesale?
They are in wholesale, they are in retail, they are in labor, they are in trade. So it's like all of those people together.
All right, so we're talking here percentages. Is there any way where we can, in dollar terms, try and quantify this business in Pakistan, this agricultural space?
Yes, absolutely. So the size of business dollar is the size of the business is between $60 and $100 billion, just in Pakistan, and it is alone. I mean, substantial enough to sort of, to create the largest. This is the largest impact. If anybody is able to solve this, which we hopefully will be, this will be the largest impact that anybody has ever created in Pakistan's history.
It's a bold statement, man. Why do you say that? That is, we've got this massive industry that accounts for a quarter of the country's GDP, constitutes nearly half of the country's workforce. Why was it so ripe for disruption? A disruption that'd be so impactful?
Absolutely. So, great question. So it needed disruption because it was a completely offline market, which consisted of two very large fragmented bases. So there was a supply base of millions of farmers. By my last count, there's about more than 8 million farmers in Pakistan.
8 million farmers?
8 million farmers in Pakistan, which are trying to serve fresh produce, meat, poultry, fish, all of these things to almost more than 1 million to close to 2 million businesses in Pakistan.
And these businesses are what? Downstream grocery stores or kind of more midstream wholesalers?
So these businesses are basically both traders, wholesaler retailers, but mostly they are like end retailers, right? These are people who sell to customers or these are restaurants or these are, so it's mainly retailers and restaurants. So there's these two very large bases of, there's a very large base on the supply side, very large base on the demand side. And given that they're, extremely fragmented, what that leads to is, the very low pricing power. When you talk about perishable produce and information asymmetry, that further sort of depletes any pricing power that both sides have.
Okay, so let's illustrate this in a hypothetical, all right? I'm an end consumer in, say, Karachi, okay? I want to buy a mango. I go to the grocery store, I buy a few mangoes. What had to happen through the supply chain to get that mango from the farm to me in Karachi?
So yeah, great question, right? So a farmer would generally, and I will also talk about the price points, right? So a farmer would cultivate mango. At the point of harvesting, he's going to sell it to somebody called a vyapari or a trader or an aggregator. So he's going to buy that, for example, say 8 or 10 or 20 acres of mangoes from the farmer for, say, 25 cents on the dollar. That trader is going to aggregate multiple farms in that space, and then he's going to sell to either a smaller wholesale market or a large wholesale market to somebody called an aarti or a commission agent. That commission agent is again going to he's going to have an auction, and then he's going to sell this off to somebody called a padia or mashapur or a wholesaler. That wholesaler is eventually going to transfer this or sell this to smaller retailers. Then the retailers are going to sell it to final consumers. What happens in the process is that 25 cents that the farmer got for the actual value addition, eventually translates into almost $1 for the customer. Therefore, the price multiplies by 4 times by the time the customer gets the final produce.
So my mango went from farmer to trader to commission agent, who then maximizes his sale price by auctioning it to a wholesaler, and then to a retailer, and then to me. Yeah, fragmented is definitely a good word.
It is. And it is mainly a function of this being, again, the extreme fragmentation, the geographical dispersion in Pakistan, where Pakistan is not a very compact country. And therefore, what this leads to is a lot of distance being traveled, multiple change of hands, lot of wastage. So according to Asian Development Bank, Pakistan's post-harvest loss is about 40%, which is staggering 60% of the produce that gets produced in Pakistan gets to a customer, 40% gets wasted, right? So that is another outcome of this inefficient supply chain that we're working on.
40% wastage, that's criminal. And with the farmer only selling his produce for 25 cents on the dollar, is he even profitable?
That's a great question, right? So during some seasons, he's profitable. During some seasons, he's not. Because sometimes, because the pricing he gets is a function of mostly supply and demand at that part of the year. And therefore, some seasons he's profitable, some seasons he's not. And he also gets almost every four crops, one crop goes bad because of weather, because of pest attack, because of some other extraneous factors. And therefore, what happens is that these people don't encounter any upward social mobility. What happens is that these people stay within the same socioeconomic class throughout the year. What compounds this problem is that these people don't even have access to capital because no bank would lend to these people. No. And what that leads to is that they even have they lend from loan sharks and they lend from these middlemen in the space. And what that eventually leads to is that any pricing power that they have also gets diluted. So it's quite a terrible situation for these people.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if your margins are so razor thin as a farmer, how do you have the capital or even the confidence to then reinvest into your harvest to continue producing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And therefore what this is leading to is people are moving away from getting into fruits and vegetables because it becomes a gamble. Sometimes you make a lot of money, but most of the times you end up losing a lot of money. And what that's leading to is that we have a stagnant supply of these fruits and vegetables year over year. But in terms of demand, that is really growing up. And Pakistan has eventually become a net importer of fruits and vegetables, which is almost unbelievable for a country which has agriculture as its backbone.
Unbelievable is right. Abrar, a country that has nearly half of its workforce working in agriculture is a net importer of agricultural products. There is such a supply-demand imbalance here.
There is. It's huge.
All right, so you identify this insane problem. What was the solution?
Right. So the solution, we spent a lot of time doing real desktop research. We looked at multiple. So we structured the problem as SAS. There are three pieces. There is what happens before the farm. We structured it as what happens on the farm and then what happens after the farm. In terms of disruption opportunity, what happens before the farm is not very interesting. What happens on the farm is something we don't have a lot of capability in. Because it's mainly work, scientists who work on, how do we improve the yield? When do we put water? All that stuff. But what happens after the farm is very interesting for us because it's a supply chain problem. We've worked on supply chain in the past. What happens after the farm is also a finance problem. And again, based on our experience in finance, we thought that we could take it on. So what we started building was a marketplace, B2B marketplace, which connects these farmers with businesses. Where Taza comes in as a buyer from these farmers, and then it sort of performs logistics operations, it performs warehousing operations, performs last mile delivery operations, and delivers to these customers. That was the initial thought, but slowly and gradually, once we realized that not only the access to market is a problem, access to capital is a huge problem in this space, and we also sort of started pivoting as both a financier as well as a marketplace.
Okay, and this finance you're providing, it's liquidity to farmers so they can invest more in their harvests?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only to the farmers, but also the businesses that we serve, because they're also very small. They're also part of the pyramid. These are people who probably, if you go to the market, they probably have the smallest shop. They will have probably the smallest tent. And we also are thinking, and already working on a pilot to provide short-term working capital loans to these people also.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, it's important to remember, these retailers aren't Whole Foods or Trader Joe's or Waitrose or Toythrooms or 7-Eleven, right? I mean, these are small, locally owned mom and pop shops, right?
Absolutely.
So when did you launch?
So we launched in the month of August. June and July was mainly a lot of market research. But we launched in the month of August. And this is our fifth full month of operation.
5 months of operation. And you've already had this headline-grabbing pre-seed raise, right?
Yes. So the pre-seed raise was the largest pre-seed raise in Pakistan's history. We raised $6.5 million. But that's not the only thing. I think what we've really been able to accomplish is building a very large scale business. Every day we serve almost 1,500 customers. This is what the number is today. Probably tomorrow is going to be 1,600. That's how fast we're growing. We've been able to build a very talented team in Pakistan. We've been able to build technology, which actually helps us execute faster and more efficiently. And as a recognition for all that we've been able to do in a very short amount of time, we've been able to see the convergence of some of the best investors in the region towards Taza, backing us to solve this very large and complex problem and create the largest impact that has ever been created in Pakistan.
Yeah, tell me about them.
Yeah, sure. So we have a lot of investors. So for example, Global Founders Capital was our first backer. They are probably, by the number of deals they do, they're the sixth largest fund in the world. They have $8 billion assets under management. They met us and they immediately, they were fast. They're very decisive. So they looked at us. They spoke to us. They looked at the market size and they said, we're in and we want to go as deep as you're comfortable with in your business and, in your cap table. So they came in very early. We have three very large funds in Pakistan backing us, including Zain Capital, including I2I Ventures, and including Fasma Gobi Ventures. These are probably some of the best investors in Pakistan. All of them add significant value. Recently, we also had a lot of interest from the Silicon Valley and from the US. Our last round was co-led by somebody called Vibe Capital. It's led by Ankur Nagpal. He had his own startup called Teachable in the US. And now he started when he spun that off, he started his own fund, which is backed by some of the best investors in the US tier ones. So he came in and, he backed us in our most recent raise. Then we have some very prolific angel investors in the US backing us, including Sahil Bloom, including Siki Chen, including somebody called Julian Shapiro. So all these people are sort of converging towards us. For some of these people, it's their first investment in Pakistan. And I think that gives us a lot of validation and confidence that the people in the Silicon Valley or in the US who don't completely empathize the problem have started seeing the potential of not only of the market, but of us as founders and as a team and the problem that we're solving.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, a lot of these Silicon Valley investors, whilst they don't see firsthand the issues that you do, they naturally understand the problem and the massive opportunity it presents. So with that in mind, Abrar, just how big is the opportunity? Let's talk numbers. Where are we now, say 5 months in?
So total customers on the platform is around 6,000, but daily active customers is around 1,500. And most of our customers place their orders with us almost every 2 days. So it's almost like a subscription kind of behavior. While there is no subscription, but their ordering pattern is such that they have to order with us almost every 2 days.
All right, so 1,500 businesses using Taza. What percentage of the total addressable market is that?
So in terms of total retailers, we'd say more than a million, between 1 million and 2 million. So when we subset our market, when we subset people that we can profitably serve, we're talking about at least 300 to 400,000 of these retailers and restaurants.
All right. So let's assume a potential TAM of, 400,000. You said you're working with about 1,500 of them. So you've got, 1 second, 0.375% of them.
Absolutely. We're just getting started. We already, the GMV that we have is quite substantial. And that's attracting a lot of these investors. That, we've been able to scale to that GMV very quickly. And two, we've not only sort of scratched the surface of the market. And three, the buying behavior is such that you can build additional financial products on top because they have acute financial needs. And also their engagement on the app is super high. And four, the gross margin potential in the space is also super high because you're disrupting a market where price gets multiplied by four before it gets to a customer. So the gross margins are already very high.
So what is your GMV right now?
So our GMV right now, we closed the month of December around between $700,000 and $900,000. And this is the fifth full month of operation.
Man, I mean, $900,000 GMV 5 months in. While also mentioning earlier that there is a 4x spread to play with between farmer and end consumer, I got to ask you a pretty hard question. Abrar, you've got this huge problem to solve in Pakistan, right? Allow farmers to make more whilst also bringing the prices of groceries down for consumers. But you're also a commercial entity with shareholders. How do you reconcile giving some of that spread to those in need whilst also keeping some of that spread and driving value for the company? Is it possible?
I think our clear answer to this is that, you know, you can do both. You can do good for the society. You can create an impact while at the same time also add value for the shareholders, and which is the concept of double bottom line, I guess. And basically, because the spread is so high that you can provide value, additional value to the farmers, you can provide lower prices to the customers while adding other forms of value, including access to capital, while adding other forms of value, including, for example, lower procurement effort for the retailers, while adding other value, including providing, you know, standardized product that does not exist in today's supply chain to these retailers by providing them doorstep delivery. So like there's multiple value adds that you can do. And while at the same time, also while you reduce the supply chain inefficiency, there's sort of more value, right? So the key question for us would be at some point in time as we scale is going to be how much of that value are we going to pass on to the society and create an impact, while how much of the value we can keep for the shareholders. But we strongly feel that we could do both.
Okay, which begs my next question. What are your margins on your $900,000 GMV?
So our gross margins are close to 5% at this point. We've been keeping them artificially low just to make sure that we grow faster, because most of the value that we are thinking about, the value that we're trying to capture and also pass on, is going to be materialized at a larger scale when you have enough buying capacity to buy from multiple farms. And, you know, there are truckloads, there are like other MOQ equations there. But so what we're trying to do at this point is just grow very fast on the scales. So blend scale, basically. And then start using some of these levers to improve our gross margins and make sure that this eventually turns into a profitable company. But at this point in time, the gross margins are artificially low so that we can grow fast.
Taking a page out of Kareem's book and your business model, Abrar, are you effectively a trader? I mean, you're taking price risk, inventory risk, storage risk. You're buying from farmers, storing it, and then selling to retailers on demand?
Absolutely. And this does involve a bit of logistics. This does involve a couple of layers of warehousing. But eventually that leads to sort of like efficiencies.
Yeah. So my next question, you know, you're making the supply chain more efficient, right? From farm to retailer to table. Not from farm to trader to commission agent to wholesaler to retailer to table, right? How do the middlemen in Pakistan feel about what you're doing at Taza?
So at this point in time, the main goal or motive that we have is to make the supply chain more efficient, right? That essentially means that even the traders, even the wholesalers, everybody gets better off, because there's such a large and very dominant market that we'd probably be making very small dents to their traditional businesses even as we scale. And what we are trying to do is make sure that, you know, we work with them to make sure that the supply chain is more efficient. So we provide these traders more value. If they want to buy from us, we sometimes sell to them. Sometimes we buy from them. So they are also now participants in this new marketplace that we're building. We're making sure that, you know, we keep them along. And secondly, I think in terms of the total size, they're like much smaller piece because they're aggregating for hundreds of farms, thousands of farms. And therefore, even if there is a negative impact, it's going to be a much smaller community as opposed to, you know, the larger value, the net impact is going to be significantly positive.
Okay, so let's go back to my mango hypothetical from earlier, okay? This time, I'm not a consumer, I'm a retailer, yeah? I've got my own shop in Karachi and some greedy, hungry American just came in and bought all my mangoes. I got to order more. So what? I go on the Taza platform, order more mangoes, and that's it? They arrive the next day?
You do. You place an order on the app. The mangoes are going to be delivered to you tomorrow based on the demand forecasts that we build. We will already have mangoes for you in our system, in our supply chain, and ready to be served to you next morning.
And what kind of impact does that have on the end consumer? I mean, by getting products faster, more efficiently, and less expensive, I hope it has an impact on buying groceries in Pakistan?
Absolutely. So at this point in time, and this again is a staggering number for an agrarian economy or a society, where almost at this point, 30% of our disposable income goes towards, on average, towards buying fruits and vegetables and other food items, which should be significantly lower.
30%?
Yes, 30%.
Abrar, man, I'm still having a hard time believing these numbers, right? I mean, 40 to 45% of the country's workforce works in agriculture, and still, the country is a net importer of products and folks spend 30% of their income on groceries?
Absolutely. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Mind-boggling, yeah. That's the word. And surely, with this problem you're solving, sorry, these problems, plural, that you're solving, I bet you've already, hopefully, got some pretty cool stories in your short 5 months of operations.
Yeah, sure. So we have like multiple, because people who we're serving, both on the farm side and the business side, are, again, people who've never been served by anyone and who've never been taken care of by anyone. So for us, once they start seeing our customer service, they're actually sort of a lot, we see a lot of gratefulness in their eyes that, you know, who are you people? I mean, why are you serving us? What do you want from us, really? So that, because these are people who've never been catered to, served to by anyone. The farmers and businesses both. We have stories of female retailers who were having a real hard time. For example, there's this female school teacher called Zarka. She retired from her school and used all her savings to set up a fruit shop for her husband. And her husband sort of ran away with that money and she was left with nothing. And then she sort of borrowed on her house. And then she started that fruit stall. And again, because she was a woman in a very male-dominated mandi or wholesale market, she never got the kind of prices that were required to actually sell profitably. And I think with 3 to 6 months into her journey, my co-founder, actually, Mohsen, in his initial days, was trying to get these acquired customers. And he went to her shop and he said that, you know, this is who we are. This is Taza. This is what we do. Would you want our service? And she said, definitely, because she was really getting the short end of the stick. And as soon as we started serving her, her sales actually multiplied by 4 times. Because now she got the right prices. And now when she got the right cost price, she could also sell at the right price. And I think she's probably now thinking of setting up another store. Because now she knows, I mean, she's getting the right price, she's getting the right delivery, and the quality is also great. And therefore, her customer base has increased significantly, and therefore, her life's completely changed. And these are like one small story among so many stories that we see every day while we serve these people, both on the supply and the demand side.
Unbelievable, right? I mean, tech can remove these human biases and worse discrimination. And like you said, in Zarka's case, who had a hard time in this male-dominated industry and even society, she's now exponentially better off.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Abrar, when we talk a year from now, January 2023, where will Taza be?
So 1 year down the road, we would be in at least one more country outside Pakistan. We will have a full suite of services, both on the access to market and access to capital side for farmers and businesses. So we'll be lending through input financing to the farmers, and we'll be providing short-term working capital loans to our customers. We'll be in more than 3 cities in Pakistan, and we'll probably have presence outside Pakistan. And we'll be much more efficient than we are today, and we'll probably be the best organization to work for in Pakistan.
All right, lots to unpack there. I guess first, in a country outside Pakistan, where?
So the jury's still out on that one. We're looking at multiple countries at this point. This is also contingent on the raises that we do from this point onwards. But we're looking at the Middle Eastern markets. We're also looking at Southeast Asian markets, including Bangladesh, including Sri Lanka, for example. So we're looking at other markets which encounter similar problems. Because what we're doing here in Pakistan is no different from what Twika did in Kenya 6 years ago or 7 years ago. Or what Ninja Card does in India, which started 6-7 years ago. So Pakistan was a bit behind on this, but now we're catching up. But the problems that we're solving are endemic in a lot of developed markets, and we want to build a global network of fruits and vegetables.
And in lending to both ends of the supply chain, Abrar, surely to keep the cost of capital down, you'd have to raise quite a bit of equity, no?
So yeah, so there are like multiple options on the table for that. We could also work with different partners who, for example, are specialized in the lending space or are better capitalized for lending in Pakistan. We're already doing one pilot with one of these other companies called Creditbook, where they're taking the exposure on their own balance sheet while we're providing them all the insights on these customers, and therefore creating a win-win situation wherein we're splitting the margins that we make consequently. So there's one option, that option is on the table. We're also probably speaking to some investors who are specialized in raising or providing debt. So that is also on the table. So we're looking at multiple options. And we're also speaking to financial institutions within Pakistan who could provide us, extend credit lines to us so that, you know, we can extend that credit forwards based on better information that we have and therefore execute this.
Now, in hearing all this, Abrar, if this works, if you get sales prices up for farmers and purchase prices down for consumers and finance both sides of the supply chain and add value for shareholders, man, I mean, what an example of entrepreneurship for good.
And that's what drives us, right? Really, right? Because we also believe, and we've seen that firsthand also, that no amount of money could sort of motivate people to do what we do, what our teams do today. And it's mainly the teams and everybody else solving for the impact or the mission that we have gets people going, because this is a very hard space to be in. It requires a lot of execution, requires a lot of hours. And I think there's just the alignment to that vision and long-term and that sort of end goal that keeps people, you know, motivated day in, day out, excited about what they do. Otherwise, you know, the money that we make or we probably are going to make maybe 5 years, 10 years down the road, probably does not justify the amount of effort that all of us are putting into this.
What a great place to end. Abrar, I cannot wait to see how far and how wide you take Tazaha. What a pleasure, man. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for the opportunity, David. Really appreciate this.
That was Abrar Bajwa from Tazaha. Not from Silicon Valley, but from Pakistan. New episodes of the podcast are released every other week, so be sure to subscribe to, share, and rate, review Not From Silicon Valley on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again. We'll see you soon.